The 15th is Jack, is Freddy's on the 15th?
Freddy is the 15th. But Freddy's wrong also. DY. Because he knew the flies. That's it. Z.
Okay, 4th yet?
No, 2.
Okay, and March 17th is meeting workshop. Have we distributed that by email?
No.
Okay, so you will soon be getting in your email.
At least.
I thought you said, but it, okay. A email for meeting workshop with several speakers about quantum physics.
And on the 14th, Elaine asked for.
Okay.
That, I think, one.
Also, there's Klebanov. Never heard of him. You know what you started?
Okay. Tell me one time.
11.
11, okay. Okay. And for people who don't know who Elaine Aspect is, Aspect, you're supposed to say, if you're not in the other room over there, foundation, Elaine Aspect is the person who did the experiment that disconfirmed the dominant qualities and proved the dominant value of quantum theory. So I don't know if that's the expulsion or not. But he will be that rare feature in this building, which is his practice. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're very, very pleased to have Justin here for a second time. And he's going to talk to us about chameleon scalar fields, and he's going to tell us what they are.
Okay, thank you. It's great to be back. And yeah, so chameleons, the topic of my talk in a nutshell, what they are, they're a candidate for the dark energy. This dark energy that we infer from observation, the mysterious component which leads to the acceleration of the universe today. And the interesting thing about these chameleons is that they can be tested locally through tests of gravity. So it opens the door to detecting dark energy with local tests. So this is work done with a bunch of people, but the original work was done with a graduate student in Menlo Park. And it's grown into a collaboration, in particular, people in Princeton and also experimental groups at Colorado and University of Washington. Okay, so first a disclaimer that you're free to ask questions, but if I know the answer, I'll tell you the answer, and if I don't, I'll just respond cleverly. Okay, so this is an exciting time for cosmology. The past decade, we've seen a bunch of new observations, new experiments that have provided us with a wealth of new data, and I've just shown a few of them here. Of course, you're all familiar with the beautiful map of the microwave background anisotropy by the WMAP satellite. And this gives us a snapshot of how the universe looked like when it was 400,000 years old. Here is the another important probe of the universe is a large-scale structure. So basically looking at galaxies and clusters, they're counting them as a function of redshift and also their statistical properties. You've all heard of supernovae, which are these violent cosmic explosions, and we can calibrate them as standard candles, and therefore by looking at their apparent brightness as a function of redshift, we can learn something about the cosmic history expansion of the universe. And finally, one more is gravitational lensing. Basically, if you have a lump of matter between you and some background galaxies, you can study the shear of these background galaxies and infer something about the total mass of the universe. Now, remarkably, these different observations, all with their different systematics and so forth, all give us a consistent picture of what the universe is today. And it consists of an ugly mess, in a nutshell. The stuff we're made of, baryons and leptons, only makes 4% of the energy budget. 23% is dark matter. Now, dark matter, although not detected directly yet, its existence was inferred as far back as 7 years ago. So we know about it from dynamics of galaxies and clusters, and it played an important role in structure formation. So this is something we're more or less comfortable with at this point. I should also stress that from a particle physics point of view, there are quite a few good candidates for the dark matter. So wimps or axions, we have these candidates whose relic density is of the right order to explain observations, let's say. But the big surprise, and what will be the focus of this talk, is that more than two-thirds of the universe is some mysterious stuff that we call dark energy. And this dark energy, its main role, if you like, is to cause the universe to be accelerating today. Okay. So why is that a big deal, acceleration? So our universe on the largest scale is close to homogeneous and isotropic. And for such a universe, the metric is very simple. It's the FRW metric, where the expansion between two observers is governed by a scale factor, A of t. Okay? And in turn, the scale factor is determined by Einstein's equations, which relates, through a second order differential equation, relates the scale factor to the energy density of the universe as such. The coefficient is involved with parameter w, which tells you about what kind of matter you're talking about, what kind of stuff, and it's given by the ratio of pressure to energy density. Okay, we call it the equation of state. Now, baryons and dark matter, being non-relativistic, have negligible pressure. Okay, and hence w is very close to zero, negligibly small. Photons and other relativistic species, as you know from thermodynamics, have a pressure which is one-third the energy density, and hence W is a third. And the bottom line is that for both of these species, basically, if the universe were just normal baryons, matter, and photons, you find that for both of these guys, the right-hand side here is negative. Hence, in a normal Big Bang cosmology, the universe starts expanding, but always at a decelerating rate, okay? Hence, the observation that the universe is accelerating tells you that there must be some form of energy whose equation of state is less than minus 1. Now, an important caveat in this argument is that I assume that Einstein's equations actually hold on the largest scales. Okay. And this may or may not be true. It's a huge extrapolation to assume that general relativity, which has been shown to hold true in the solar system, to assume that it holds to the largest scales is a big extrapolation. So in particular, this dark energy, as you know, could be a cosmological constant, okay? And introduced by Einstein historically to obtain a static universe, he then called it his greatest blunder, and perhaps it's a bit ironic that today lambda is coming back to haunt cosmologists. But indeed, so lambda is basically perfectly homogeneous in space and time, and its equation of state, if you model it as an effective fluid, is exactly minus one, okay? So just two side remarks. Is that things have evolved since Einstein, and the advent of quantum mechanics has taught us that, in fact, a non-zero cosmological constant is, in fact, expected from particle theories. The big problem is, in fact, that the observed value is very small, many orders of magnitude too small, so maybe e to the fourth power, compared to the theoretical expectation, that's the lower bound of 1 to e to the fourth, okay, the naive expectation. So you need an extreme amount of fine-tuning in order to get the right lambda. So the question is then, since lambda has this precise value of w, which is minus one, what can the data tell us? Can it tell you that it's minus one or something else? Okay. Now, unfortunately, in cosmology, you cannot go and measure w directly from observations. Because any given observation will have some amount of degeneracies between different parameters. You vary one, vary the other, and you get the same result. Okay? So the way to actually beat down on these degeneracies is to combine different observables. Okay? So this is the state-of-the-art, this latest paper by Uroš Seljak. And what they do is they basically combine CMB data with galaxy statistics and supernovae. And they end up with this yellow contour. Okay? What I'm plotting here is the equation of state. And here is the fraction of matter, fraction of energy density in matter.
Okay. Does bias mean that they're trying to get the answer they want?
No. So bias is basically that, so you're looking, say, at galaxies or other forms of structure, and you're looking at them through their, how should I say, first of all, these are clustered objects, and you're inferring, by looking at their statistical properties, something about the underlying power spectrum. So if you like, right, so at any given scale, the clustering properties of two clusters, let's say, or two galaxies, will be larger than the underlying power spectrum. And that's the bias. And there's, of course, you have to be, there's some assumptions that need to be made about it. Okay. So in the end of the day, this yellow contour, as you can see, this W being minus 1, which is a cosmological constant, sits pretty much in the middle of this contour. But there is quite a bit of uncertainty of the order of 10% on it at the moment. Okay. An important assumption in this fitting is that you assume that W is in fact a constant function of redshift. It does not evolve. But since we don't know anything about the dark energy, in general you should let this parameter be a function of time. And the way to parameterize it is not God-given, so you have to make some assumption. And the typical parameterization is just a linear fit. Okay, here's a constant value, and it's linear in the scale factor. W1 is the derivative. And repeating the analysis, now of course you have an extra parameter, so your contours are going to be broader. Indeed, that's what happens. And the cross here is, of course, again lambda, so with no time variation and W being minus 1. And then you can see that the error bars have increased significantly. Okay. So the main message I'm trying to say is that it's still far from clear that it is a cosmological constant. Okay, there's still plenty of room for future observations to show that that W is not minus 1. So suppose that we do find that W is not minus 1. What can we infer? What could we say about the dark energy? So one candidate, although not the only one as Rachel told us yesterday, one candidate, possibly the simplest extension to a cosmological constant, is a so-called quintessence model, where you just have a scalar field which is rolling down a potential like this one. And what plays the role of the vacuum energy is this potential energy that the scalar field has. And of course, now the field is rolling, so as a function of time, this vacuum energy is changing. So to first order, it's just a time-dependent vacuum energy. In this case, the equation of state for this scalar is the ratio of pressure to energy density is given by some combination of kinetic minus potential, kinetic plus potential. In particular, this is trivial, but if the field were sitting fixed at some point, kinetic energy would be zero, and you would recover W being minus 1 for a cosmological constant. But since the field is rolling, in general, W will not be minus 1. And for slow roll, that is, if the field is not rolling too fast, then the equation of state can be less than minus a third, and then you have acceleration. Now, a fiducial example of the quintessence potential is the inverse parallel potential, so 1 over pi to the n, where m here is some mass scale, okay, that you put in. And although we know that the universe has been accelerating recently, in the past we know that it was pretty much following a normal Big Bang cosmology with a deceleration. So you don't want the universe to be accelerating too early on. And the epoch at which acceleration is triggered, you basically dial it in by a choice of m. Okay? And for the acceleration to occur in the recent past and not way earlier, you need to pick this value to be a milli eV. So the amount of tuning, maybe eV was the same scale that we had for lambda, the amount of tuning is comparable between quintessence and lambda models. Now, another feature of these models is that this scalar field phi is nearly massless. It has a mass which is of the order of the Hubble constant today, or this tiny scale of 10 to the minus 33 eV. And that will play an important role in this talk. The reason for this, dynamically, is just that, it's quite simple. You want the vacuum energy to shift by a significant amount over the history of the universe so that W is not too close to minus 1. So the field has to be rolling. And in order for it to be rolling, it wants to roll because of the potential, but it's fighting against the friction due to the Hubble expansion of the universe. Okay, and for the roll to be to be not too fast or not to be fixed, it has to have a mass comparable to the expansion rate. So that's what you find. And hence, on any reasonable length scale in the laboratory or so, yes?
I didn't mean to interrupt you in that sense.
No.
But how do you know that the universe is accelerating in all previous epochs except for now?
Oh, okay. So, right. That's a good point. That's a fair point. So, well, first of all, in order to form structure, okay, that's probably the mildest requirement. In order to form structure, you need the universe to be able to clump, matter to be able to clump. If the universe was accelerating, if you didn't have a period of matter domination, then things would be pulled apart too fast to form galaxies.
Okay. It only requires a period of matter, maybe an average depth, doesn't affect the sequence of intervals in which there was acceleration.
Oh, small intervals of acceleration. Sure, okay. Perhaps some very tuned mechanism or some weird models.
Well,
and then, okay.
I don't know, I don't think it's so weird.
Okay, okay. Well, you used to, okay. I should have said it was weird. I should say you would have to come up with such a model and then run it and see through codes like CMB-BAS and see if it gives you a reasonable cosmology. I'm just saying there's a bunch of non-trivial checks to be made. Yes.
That's true.
You could still have these little bursts if you want somehow. Well, you average over a certain edge. Yeah, okay. Yes.
If you figure out that W is less than minus 1, can you generate the
Ah, good, okay. So that's a very interesting question. So, not with this model, because from the previous transparencies, W was strictly greater or equal than minus 1. Now people have tried to make ad hoc modifications. So if you were to just change the sign of the kinetic term, then it would be possible to, but these models, in my opinion, I don't want to make controversial claims, but they're of course unstable classically. They have a bunch of issues. But that's a very interesting question. I'm working on this as well. And if you were to measure W being less than minus 1, then you've already greatly reduced the size of the class of possible models. At the moment, there are very few models that I find are consistent and give you W less than minus 1. So certainly there's a window of opportunity for theorists. Okay, so the bottom line is just that if you have a scalar with such a tiny mass, then on any scale that you're interested in, this phi, if it were to interact directly with matter, will mediate a long-range force.
Are we supposed to care that
So I can't claim that I've derived such a potential from some fundamental theory, but at least these sort of non-perturbative potential do have, they're not precisely 1 over x to the n, but they typically have these generic behavior that becomes flat in some direction, some with that kind of curve.
It's a very small quadratic curve, right, from phi, because it's massive.
Right, that's Taylor expanded about the value today. It's that statement is obtained by Taylor expanding this potential about the value today. So I'm saying if you do small perturbations about this value, you'll pick up a two leading order quadratic term, and it's that term which is the mass. So the way I'm defining mass squared is that it's the second derivative of the potential at the value today. Okay. So it really is the mass of small fluctuations about that value. No, that's right. That's right. So the average value is rolling, but okay. You're looking at small fluctuations locally. I mean, it's rolling on a Hubble time scale. It's very slow. Okay, so this is a more or less a pictorial description of, so what could this scalar be, okay? Now, a priori string theory presents us with a plethora of scalars. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of them. But one general feature that they have is that they measure the size or shape of extra dimensions. Okay, so there's an important consequence of this, which is, so if you consider this toy example, so I could say, so as you know, string theory is a theory consistent in many dimensions, 10 or 11. So in order to get four big dimensions, you need to actually compactify the rest of them, typically on some small manifold. So a very naive example is just the example of a cylinder where you do have one large dimension and a tiny one on a circle like this. The circumference of this circle is measured by phi. Okay. And now phi can actually, of course, the circumference can vary as a function of x. So therefore, from the point of view of someone living extended in the x direction, this phi will represent a function. So it's a field, if you like, from the point of view of the logic mirror. What this implies is that the strength of gravity will then depend on the size of the extra dimensions, because now if you have two test masses in your universe, the gravitational flux won't simply propagate along the big dimensions, it will also permeate the small dimensions. And the bigger you make those extra dimensions, the more flux will leak. Okay, so the weaker the effective gravity you'll measure. So all I'm saying is G Newton is actually a function of the scalar. In other words, the gravitational field of the scale of the Earth, let's say, can be Taylor expanded at some constant piece, which is the gravitational field we measure, plus an extra piece proportional to the radius of phi. Okay, and that extra piece is an extra force. So what I'm saying is just that phi mediates a fifth force. And for a massive scalar, the potential energy is given by the Yukawa form, like this, where you have an exponential suppression on scales larger than M inverse. And here, these betas basically tell you about the strength of the force. There are two generic outcomes that you find from these compactifications in string theory. It's not the only outcome, but what I would claim is a generic one, is that these betas typically are of order unity, which means that the force is of comparable strength to gravity if this is order one. Okay. And moreover, they can be different for different matter species. Okay, I here labels different, just different particles. Okay. So the strength of this force is not universal, which is in contrast with normal gravity. So you expect that this force will result in violations of the equivalence principle, or universality of free fall. And that's parameterized by this Edbach parameter eta. So if you have a ball of copper and beryllium, the relative free fall acceleration is given by this, of course, and then that will be proportional to the difference in, so basically the beta of the Earth times the difference in betas for the two test masses. And this quantity is constrained remarkably to be less than 1 part of 10 to the 3. So remarkable bound, and that's from the experiment at University of Washington. So the final bottom line of the motivation is that if such a quintessence scalar exists, that is to say, if you were to measure that W is different than minus 1, then the obvious question is why haven't we detected it through tests of the equivalence principle, or other tests of gravity. So normally, the assumption that people make is that these couplings are set arbitrarily small by hand. Okay, that's the generic assumption. You just assume that they're whatever, 10 to the minus 4, or 10 to the whatever, to satisfy this bound.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Next to the edge, we have a wedge, right? Five,
oh, wedge. Correct. So you could make them very massive.
It's enormous because it's the size of the horizon.
That's right. That's
so
right.
So this is the composition of the experiments. Only if it results once in about 100 astronomical units. So you get about
well, I agree, and that would be sort of the. Well, okay, so that would be actually the point of the talk, in fact. So I'm glad you point this out. Is that there's a big assumption, which is that I've made a statement about the mass of the scalar on cosmological scales, and then locally it could behave quite differently. But that's precisely what chameleons are about. So what are chameleons? They're essentially what I just described. They have couplings of order gravitational strength to matter, and moreover, they have a tiny mass on cosmological scales. And how you avoid the argument I've just given? Well, there are two ways, one of which, the first one is that the mass of this chameleon is actually a function of the density, a function of the, it depends on the local matter density. So in a region of high density, the mass is large, and therefore, so on Earth, let's say, the mass is very large, and then the spin force is exponentially suppressed. But when you get to cosmological density, some 30 orders of magnitude smaller, then the range can become quite large and allow, hopefully, for a rolling scalar field. Yes?
Okay. Thinking about mass, the distribution of point-like objects,
right.
Doesn't that imply some sort of non-locality in the field theory that the chameleon? The chameleon should somehow field around it. It's not, the mass.
Right,
not
so it will course range the. So a little later on, I can address. That's a very good question. Okay, mm-hmm. But indeed, it coarse grains the microscopic delta function.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but I'll explain these two effects in turn. It's not the yes.
So if you also speak in time, this first point that the mass of the chameleon will increase with this quadruple synthesis. I mean, nowadays the vacuum energy is of the same order as.
Right. No. It doesn't. So the No, so you'll see how it goes. The mass, this will be a nearly homogeneous, the chameleon in the early universe will be nearly homogeneous. So when I say the mass, it's really, if you like, how fast it rolls along these potentials. It's not like you have a bunch of these excitations over closing the universe. Okay, but that's a good question. We'll see that it's always subdominant, except for today. The second point, I'll explain these two things in detail, but the second point in a nutshell, is that there's a second way in which the chameleon can make itself difficult to detect, and that's through the spin shell theorem. And the intuition here is that it's not a linear theory, so you can't just sum up the scalar charge of a given object and say, okay, it's not the sum of the constituents. But what you'll find is that only a thin shell near the edge of the object actually contributes to the force outside, in contrast with what you learn in E&M or Newtonian gravity.
That theorem is based on some sort of more explicit description of this thing, yes.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, I don't mean theorem in any, okay. It's just a thin shell phenomenon, but I'll show how it occurs. So let's start with the first effect, which is this density-dependent mass. And so how do you get this in practice? So this is probably the slide with most equations, but the typical effective action you get when you have such a scalar is you have normal Einstein-Hilbert, a kinetic term for the scalar, a potential, and here I've added the action for a collection of non-relativistic particles, such as baryons, electrons, whatever. And it's an integral over the path of each of these non-relativistic particles, and mi is their mass. And if there was no phi dependence, it's easy to show that if you vary this action with respect to the path, you would actually derive a geodesic equation for these non-relativistic particles. But here, in fact, the mass will depend on phi. The reason is that I've said earlier that the strength of gravity depended on phi, and all I've done here is, instead of thinking of G Newton as dependent on phi, I've sort of set G Newton as a constant, and I've shoved all the phi dependence into the masses. I can Taylor expand the mass as a function of the scalar to some constant plus a linear term, which where beta here is a constant. And so as before, the potential will be some monotonically decreasing function, such as the 1 over 5 to the n, as in quintessence. If you vary this action with respect to phi, you find the usual box phi and the source term from the self-interactions, plus an extra term which comes from the fact that if you have matter around, this matter has a mass which depends on phi. So this will source the phi field itself. So you will get an extra term proportional to the density of the matter that's sitting around. This is, for non-relativistic species, this is an exact equation. Okay, so it is a bunch of delta function, and then we'll assume that we're coarse grain, and we'll check that it's a consistent assumption. What this is telling you is that in vacuum, the field would just want to roll out to infinity, but in the presence of matter, really there's this extra piece which is contributing to its dynamics. So really you should think of the entire right-hand side of this potential as a sum of the normal potential plus a piece which is proportional to the density.
Does the Emelian interact with photons?
Not in this model, no. No, it doesn't. Although you could generalize it. For the simple Bode model, I'd assume it's a conformal coupling. So really, if you were to add photons and other massless species, what would appear here is not the density, but it would be the trace of the stress test. If you plot this potential, what it looks like is, so the sum of two is this decaying normal potential, and then you have this rising density piece. And so the sum of the two has a minimum if beta is positive. So although in vacuum the field wants to run up to infinity, in the presence of matter, it actually wants to sit at the minimum, sitting right here. And this minimum, it's easy to convince yourself that it depends on the density. As I raise the density, this curve will go up, this straight line, and then the minimum will shift higher up on the potential. And similarly, the mass of these of small fluctuations about the minimum will also grow as a function of the density. So as I raise the density and you climb higher up on the potential, this effective potential is narrowing down, and then the mass is getting larger. So the conclusion is that in the dense environment, where the density is large, the fifth force is exponentially suppressed. Now, you want to make sure that local tests of gravity can be satisfied in this scenario. And there's no evidence for the existence of a fifth force down to about 100 microns at the moment. Okay, so what they do is they just look at deviation from 1 over r squared between two test masses. So therefore, to satisfy these laboratory constraints, what you want to impose is that the range of the chameleon in the atmosphere, so around us, is less than a millimeter. And then, if you do this, then of course the force between a test mass and the Earth will be exponentially suppressed because the distance is much longer than a millimeter. Okay, so you satisfy, in one shot, you satisfy both the fifth force and the equivalence principle constraints locally. And then you can ask, once I've set, so that's the one constraint on the model, if you like. That's the most stringent constraint. And once you've set this bound, you can ask, now as a function of density, what will be the range of the chameleon? So for solar system density, so at the generic point in the solar system, the density is 20 orders of magnitude or so smaller than in the atmosphere. And here you find that the range is 10 to 1,000 astronomical units in the solar system. So it's a long-range force. And that's already a red flag. You don't want to mess up the orbits of planets if you have such a long-range interaction. On cosmological scale, the density is another factor, another 10 orders of magnitude smaller, and here you find that the range is a kiloparsec. So a remarkable hierarchy from a millimeter to a kiloparsec. What we've done is simply, we basically took advantage of the existing hierarchy of densities in our universe and turned it into a hierarchy of ranges in this way. Now, a side note is that this is not quite long enough compared to what we originally wanted. We wanted a scalar which had a mass or a range comparable to the size of the universe, and that's off by 6 orders of magnitude. Okay. But okay, this is for some specific potential, and maybe we can improve upon that. Now, the second effect, which is the Fincher theorem. So here's pictorially how it arises. You imagine you have a solid sphere, so some homogeneous sphere of density rho n and some radius r. And this sphere is immersed in some homogeneous background of density rho out. You can think of this as the Earth sitting in the solar system or a baseball sitting in the atmosphere. And you want to solve this, corresponding to this internal density, you have some effective potential and some value of the minimum. And with the outside density, similar phenomena. And we want to solve the equation of motion for the chameleon with boundary conditions that the solution is regular at the origin, and that far away from the body, the field tends to this value which minimizes the potential. So that condition enforces that there is no force between a test mass and the body at infinity. Now, here's just a toy picture of what happens. So as a warm-up exercise, let's just consider a normal mass of scalar field, such as a Newtonian gravity or Coulomb interactions. So normally, to calculate the field for an observer outside, what you do is you break up the sphere into small, tiny volume elements. And you pick one of them, and of course, it will contribute the 1 over r force, to the 1 over r potential to this guy sitting outside. And then you sum up all these tiny volume elements, and at the end of the day, you find that the field that this profile outside is given by the total mass divided by the distance of those. Now, in the chameleon case, the story is quite different, because although the mass of the scalar field is zero out here, or nearly zero, inside the object is very dense, and then the range is actually much smaller, so let's say about a millimeter. So if you pick a random volume element sitting in the core, the flux coming from this volume element will be exponentially suppressed at a distance of 1 millimeter away from it. So a generic volume element inside does not contribute to the field outside. But if you take something that's near the surface, then there's nothing to suppress it. The flux can escape and reach the observer in the exterior. So what you find is that only volume elements that sit within a thin shell near the edge contribute to the force for an outside observer. So you find the answer we had before times the thin shell suppression of delta r over r. So just to summarize the story, if you have a big object like the Earth, then for the scalar field, the object basically looks like a hollow sphere. Okay? Nothing's happening inside, and all the fun is happening within the surface, this thin shell, basically. And the field and the force is suppressed by this thin shell factor. Yes?
Yeah, probably that's right.
Effectively, you can probably rewrite it as an effective Newton's law. Right. But this is coming from a microscopic theory. And it's because of this effect that, so if you take two large objects, like the Sun and the Earth, then their force between them will be suppressed by 2 powers of this thin shell factor. Okay. And that's really why all the solar system tests are satisfied in our model. So I said earlier it was a long-range force in the solar system, but now these tests always involve basically the force between some big object like the Sun or the Earth and some other object like a satellite. And hence, there's always this thin shell suppression factor which comes in. However, for a small object, if the object is sufficiently small, then any volume element you pick won't have any suppression. The flux will just escape to the outside. So you'll get something that goes at 1 over r, no suppression. So the obvious next step is just to go and suppose you consider going in space and putting 2 test masses in orbit. So here they are, and the satellite which is going in orbit, and you measure the force between them. Now, these are small test masses, and therefore they don't have a thin shell. And moreover, they're in orbit, where the atmospheric density is negligibly small, and hence the force is long range, very much like in the solar system. So the force is much longer range than the size of the satellite. So it's really a 1 over r squared correction. So the total force, therefore, between these two little guys will be the normal Newtonian force plus the correction that will go as beta squared. So if you did a Cavendish experiment out there in orbit, you would find this kind of force swap between the two test masses. And therefore, G Newton, which is the G Newton we observe in the lab, plus a correction of order unit. Now, fortunately, there are some experiments that will do just what I described. The first approximation. There's the satellite energy exchange mission, which will be a satellite floating at orbiting at 500 kilometers in altitude, and will measure the three-body interaction between a big test mass, a small test mass, and the Earth. And they plan to measure G Newton to accuracy of 1 part in 10 to the 7. And we predict the fact that they could measure delta G over G of order unity. So a whopping signal for this experiment. And similarly, for the equivalence principle, you can repeat basically the experiment of Galileo Galilei, but in orbit. So there are three planned experiments, and the most the one that's going to happen the soonest will be microscope in 3 years or so. And there are a couple of other ones. And here's the accuracy that they plan to obtain on eta, the Sedbusch parameter. So what they do, they take two concentric cylinders of different composition, and as these guys are going in orbit, they look for a difference in their axis of symmetry. So here are the bounds, and then we find that they could measure the value in space for this parameter to be bigger than what's currently allowed in the laboratory. So any of these two outcomes or results would be a strong sign of a chameleon. Yes. So gravity probe B, so there's no direct spin coupling because that's a scalar. And the other effect would be back reaction. So therefore, the only way to talk to gyroscope would be through back reaction of the scalar of the geometry. And you can show that the back reaction is small. So it doesn't affect the geometry very much. The reason, again, for this spin shell, basically. Right.
Finally, you saw 1950 or 60 years too, before you touched on this. And they're not that far ahead.
Right, okay, so that's a good question. So there are two statements to be made, okay? First of all, they're dense. So naively, to this order of approximation, they both have a thin shell. And you can really think of this as effectively a Brent-Stinky theory with a very large Brent-Stinky parameter. So it's well within the bounds. However, there's a caveat which deserves further attention, which is the fact that these have a surface Newtonian potential which is significant, if I'm not mistaken, of order 0.2. And everything I'm doing here is in the weak field limit. So chameleons in sort of mildly strong gravity systems could be quite interesting, something I haven't studied.
So,
right.
No corrections for that.
I'm sorry?
Very little correction for them.
Right. Right. Okay, so that was the test in space, and now work in progress with people in Princeton is to look at how you could go about measuring them in the lab. So if you take two small, sufficiently small test masses, so of order 10 microns or a millimeter, then these guys won't have a thin shell, and you can hope to see something even in the laboratory. And there are two experiments, Colorado and Stanford, that have been using these small test masses, but they need to improve their sensitivity by a factor of a few. And the signature is that in this case, the fit force depends on the size of the test masses. Of course, if you have big test masses, then the force is suppressed, and as you reduce the size, you start seeing a signal. So it's not just dependent on the distance between them. So as we search for very hard things to find, it's good to keep in mind some word of advice from people used to searching, that the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. So what about cosmology with a chameleon? We know something about gravity, like through the evolution of our universe. So what a chameleon looks like in a cosmological environment, the equation of motion for homogeneous and isotropic universe is given by this. So here's the Hubble friction term that I've alluded to earlier, which tends to slow down the field. And the source terms are, again, the potential and something that depends on the density, the matter density. Now, in this case, and just to make a point to answer someone that asked this question earlier, in general, this would be the trace of the stress tensor. But for relativistic species, the trace is zero. So all you're left with is just the non-relativistic matter contributing. And of course, this matter is now redshifting, diluting, as one upon the scale factor cube, since the universe is expanding. So the picture is this, that as the universe expands, the green lines here, which are the cube of the matter, are basically becoming flatter. Hence, the minimum is actually shifting to the right as the universe expands. Now, it's important that if you start at the minimum, do you actually follow the minimum as the potential evolves? And the answer is yes, because effectively the mass of the chameleon about the minimum, the time scale of response, which is M inverse, is much bigger than the time scale over which the density is changing, and that's the Hubble time. So this is basically a rough adiabatic argument that that the field can respond quickly. Okay? So being at the minimum is an attractor, which is important because everything I said so far assumed that the field is today nicely sitting in its minimum, and that would be that would require fine tuning if this was not an attractor solution dynamically. And then a quick remark is that, as in quintessence, you still need to do some fine tuning to dial when this potential energy will start dominating the energy density of the universe. So that tuning remains. So you need to pick some mass scale to be a mini EV, which is encoded in your potential. Now, that's fine. I mean, that tuning was already there to begin with. The tuning that we managed to get rid of was this tuning of the betas, because now beta is far more than unity in this model. Then just a quick word about the basin of attraction. If you started far away from the minimum, you can show, I won't go through all of the details, but you can show that, so basically if you started way too far, then you would never make it to the minimum by single geosynthesis, okay, where you want to be. And you can show that you can start as far as about an initial value of order m tonic. Or if you think of it at reheating, let's say that the inflaton dumps a bunch of energy into the scalar and have it, and then basically it starts up here and it's being kicked and ends up at some value, then the fraction of the energy density you can put at reheating into the scalar field has to be less than about a sixth or so. So something of order not very much less than one. So say equipartition at reheating would nicely satisfy this. So now I'm going to shift gears and we'll forget about dark energy altogether. Since chameleons have these nice properties for tests of gravity, we'll just talk about some toy model that has nothing to do with dark energy, but just a simple quartic potential for a scalar. So here's the potential. And in vacuum, it has zero mass. So the field sits here, it's massless. And we're going to choose the coupling to be negative to matter. So in this case, the line is decreasing. And again, you get some minimum, so the field wants to stick here. The remarkable thing is that here there is no tunable, I mean, there is no mass scale to tune. So all you have is this dimensionless coupling to C. And if you pick C to the order 1, then you find that the range in the atmosphere, range for atmospheric density, is a millimeter. So it comes out numerically to be this way. And again, just as in the previous model, you have a density-dependent mass and a thin shell effect, both of which contribute to suppressing the third force. I should make an obvious point, which I haven't made, which is, so why they're called chameleons, obviously, is because their properties depend on the environment, and also because this field is using the environment to hide itself from local tests.
What coupling together did you look at in this model?
Oh, so similar to what I've been using. So basically, beta, mass. Yeah, so it's a basically dimension 5. So it's beta 5 over m Planck times the mass per mass. So it's m Planck suppressed. Okay. Now, the cool thing is that, so now let's just consider constraints from fifth force experiments. So here's the plot from the current bounds, and here what I'm plotting is alpha, which is the strength of the fifth force, and it's related to, it's basically beta squared in my old notation. And lambda is the range of the force, which is then inverse in my old notation. And here are the various bounds from different experiments, and you can see the line of interest is this 10 to the 0 line, which is alpha equals 1, which is basically gravitational strength fifth force. And you can see there's no evidence, so that of course the shaded region is ruled out, and there's no evidence for fifth force down to about tens of microns at the moment. But if you turn on a quartic coupling with C over unity, then all of a sudden all these experiments that were using big test masses see their constraints getting weaker because of this thin shell effect. So you see Esbach and Irvine being pushed up way higher. And Colorado and Stanford are using very small test masses, so they're not affected. The bottom line is that the line of 10 to the 0 is allowed. But Colorado, with his small test masses, is very close to being able to probe it. So we're talking with them to go after the signal, basically. So, and then there are signatures for this 5 to the 4th, 5th force, which is, first of all, it depends, again, sensitively on the size of the test masses, as I've shown in the previous figure. And moreover, and that's an important point, is that the deviations from 1 over r squared are actually distinguishable from just the Yukawa massive scalar. Okay. So you'll be able to tell if it's just some massive scalar, or is it actually a chameleon with a 5-4 interaction. And this is work in progress. We're actually calculating for experimental setup. We want to see what kind of signal they will observe. And so we're talking to these experimental groups. So I'll just conclude. The bottom line is that dark energy is a real mystery at this point. It could be a cosmological constant. It might well be in the end. But if not, if you measure that W is different than minus 1, then a likely candidate would be something like quintessence. Would be the simplest extension. Chameleons are quintessence-like scalars, except that they have direct interactions with matter. And in with that respect, they have gravitational strength interaction. So in that respect, from a theoretical point of view, they greatly expand the class of allowed models. So for decades, people would always say that if you had a scalar coupled to matter, its couplings have to be less than 10 to the minus 4, something ridiculously small. But here, beta order unity becomes fine. I hope I've convinced you that they have a rich phenomenology. So in particular, they open the door to detecting dark energy with local tests. And they have signatures for experiments, both in the lab and in space. And then finally, a few more speculative or work in progress or things to think about. Applications to astrophysics or cosmology. So one of them is what happens in strong gravity regions, like John was alluding to. So, or with black holes, what kind of signal would that give for LIGO, one of those experiments? And then a couple of more speculative ideas: could chameleon excitation, so if you imagine a reheating that produces these excitations about the minimum, could these relic particles play the role of dark matter today? Okay, so the homogeneous evolution of the scalar would be the dark energy, and these inhomogeneities, these excitations, would be dark matter particles. Now, of course, it's going to be very hard, to be honest with you, to get the right relic density. Okay. But it's something worth studying. And then maybe a more philosophical point, which is, could something like a chameleon fifth force replace dark matter? Okay, so what I mean by this is that, just qualitatively speaking, it does behave a bit like what you want dark matter to do, in the sense that on small scales, locally, it actually does nothing, because you just have normal gravity. And then when you get to the kiloparsec scales, or galactic scales, all of a sudden it produces a fifth force, which is interesting. Okay, so at least, and the cool part is that this would normally, if I just told you this, you would think that this would have to come from a known local theory, okay? Something that has nothing to do on small scale and then all of a sudden turns on large scale. But here, it was derived effectively from a local theory. So I think those are things that are worth looking at. Thank you very much.
So is the essence of this that the gravitation that we see in the solar system is essentially entirely due to general relativity effects, so the scalar
that's right.
The reason I was asking about the photons was looking as if this thing doesn't really affect the photons, and thus I was wondering about the gravitational lensing question of light.
Ah, yes, right, that's right. So that's a good point. So it wouldn't affect lensing through direct modification of null geodesics. It would have an effect through back reaction, change the profile of the chameleon, change the metric. But like I said earlier, it's unfortunately a small effect.
Given that, with the mass measured by lensing,
Oh, I'm sorry, you're worried about this point? Is that what you're...
No, with the mass, with the mass measured by Lindsay and Ben, the different, that the mass is measured by the Bayesian curves. This chameleon force is affecting the Bayesian curve.
Yeah, so if the, that's right. If you could show that on a satellite particle orbiting the galaxy or the cluster that there is a significant fifth force coming from the chameleon, then indeed you would see a discrepancy between the mass inferred from these dynamical observations and from Lansing. Okay. To give you a completely honest answer, the galaxy itself, when coarse-grained to those scales, is a very dense, it's still pretty dense object, therefore they will again, this thin shell which suppresses. I mean, it's something that ought to be calculated, but I think that's an interesting possibility. Yeah. I mean, the Lensing, as far as I know, I'm not an expert, but it's not, we don't have a precise matching. There's still a factor of order unity, which is missing. So even if G. Newton was a little bit different, I don't think it would. Yes.
Can you give this Tyrolean corrections to guys like over action, for example, by
So the history of this, just for people. So some group postulated that maybe you could have theories that would be like 1 over r, and these sort of very non-local looking operators. Those guys, those class of theories can be shown to be equivalent to a scalar tensor theory. And in that particular model, that was ruled out. Okay. But indeed, then you can ask, for something like a chameleon, could you write it effectively as a f of r as opposed to just 3g? And indeed, you can do it. But some people have pointed out that it's possible.
I have a similar question, but I didn't quite understand the answer. I thought the important thing was the differential coupling of the chameleon.
Oh, that's a good point. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's a very good point. Correct. So indeed, those theories would be Gransky. I apologize. Yeah, that's absolutely correct.
Okay, so then
so in the limit where all the betas are the same, then it can be reduced to such a theory. Otherwise, I don't think it can. That's why. Thank you. Thank you for pointing this out.
So following on that, I was wondering, in the traditional Gransky theory, is this thin shell effect also present? Is it just something that people overlook? Or is something special to this form of coupling that there's?
So it's not so much a coupling to matter that does it, but it's really, it's the interplay with the scalar potential. So, because you have this effective minimum. Now,
there's some free potential. So
I've searched the literature a little bit on how much work people have done in Gransky theories adding a potential. But as far as I can tell, all they do is linearize the equations. So here, gravity was linearized, but the actual profile of the scalar was nonlinear. It changes by huge orders of magnitude. So I don't think that part has been studied.
So is it possible that the traditional gravity theory was an appropriate choice of potential?
Sure.
Could become again experimentally viable in the same way?
That's right. I mean, this model in the limit that the betas are all the same is a Gransky theory with a potential. That's correct.
So do you have some special reason for favoring this kind of coupling as opposed to the traditional model?
I'm sorry. Oh, I see what your question is. Okay. Yeah, because the point is that so the coupling that I was assuming was M. I was Taylor expanding the mass as something like this, okay? But secretly, you could, the Gransky coupling, actually, so Gransky is actually a mass times an exponential in this Einstein frame. So you could use the exponential, which would come from Gransky, and then since phi always is much less than F block, it would reduce to what I've been studying. But you said yesterday was a good sign.
I've already asked.
Right. wonderful. In that case, let's thank Justin.
Thank you very much.
And that means, well,